Living on Earth needs your support to be heard each week. Kindly give what you can today by using the donate link to the left of this page. Thanks.
The human race has been wiped off the face of the earth. Wild animals are occupying our homes. New York City is a forest with rivers running where streets used to be. No, it's not a sci-fi movie. It's the premise of a new best-selling book by journalist Alan Weisman called The World Without Us. Alan Weisman joins me now. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Steve.
Now, this is kind of a difficult premise to swallow, Alan. I mean, that humans just one day would, poof, be gone from the Earth all at once, leaving the rest of the world in place. Not so likely, I would think.
Not at all. The idea is rather far-fetched, though it's theoretically possible. And there was a method to my madness for choosing this. You know, there's so much important stuff being written about the environment, and yet a lot of people shy away from reading it because it's daunting, it's overwhelming, it's depressing, or sometimes it's downright scary. And the bottom line is we're scared, you know, are we all going to die? So I pose this little fantasy that wipes us all out in the first couple of pages of the book, and yet we get to hang around and see, well, what would happen next? And that turns out to be just irresistibly seductive to readers. It's kind of fun. You're not worried about death because it's assumed, you know, that this is a fait accompli. And, you know, up to that point, it's kind of science fictional, but from then on, some very deep research all over the world revealed to me and many, many surprising things about what would happen. How long would it take nature to wipe out all our traces? Or could it? Have we done some indestructible things? You know, how would the rest of nature respond without our daily pressures? What have we set in motion that would take a long time to wind down?
So at the very beginning, what happens a day after humans are gone from the planet?
Well, a day after humans are gone, all of our best efforts to hold nature back so it doesn't tear our stuff apart, it just gets underway. And I have a chapter called Unbuilding Your House in which suddenly no one is there fighting off mold, keeping the insects out, keeping the mice out, keeping the woodpeckers out, keeping the water out. Pretty soon, water will be just undermining all kinds of things. Pipes will break if you live in an area that freezes. And after a while, rust will penetrate even the waterproof goop. Pretty soon, the trusses are starting to go. And within a couple of decades, your walls start to sag as the struts in the roof are splaying. And a roof will go untended within 50, maximum 100 years if you're lucky. And once that goes, in a little after a century, only the chimney will be standing.
It's a cellar hole and a chimney. Now, what if we were to look, say, a week out after humans disappear? What would our cities look like? What would it be like in New York City, for example?
Well, I use the example of New York. It's one thing for a wood frame house to disintegrate, but we really think of our steel and concrete cities as being pretty indestructible. The weak spot, I learned in New York City, and in many other cities, it turns out, is that the subway tunnels are below the water table. So the subway engineers have to contend with, even on a sunny day, about 13 million gallons of water that are rushing around trying to fill up the subways. They have nearly 800 pumps under New York to send that water uphill, pump it into the sea. If they weren't there, or if no one were manning our power plants, the power would go off, the pumps would go off, the subways would fill with water just within the first week, within the first few days. And then the columns that are holding up the ceilings, which are essentially the streets, would begin to rust. And within 15, 20 years, they would be decomposing enough that they would be buckling and the streets would start to cave in. And eventually, as they collapsed, we would have rivers on the surface once again. The 456 line underneath Lexington Avenue would basically restore a river that once ran there.
The Lexington Avenue River, huh?
Exactly, the Lexington. And birds would start dropping fish in it or clams, and it would repopulate rather quickly.
So 1,000 years out, what would New York City look like?
Well, 1,000 years out, I don't think there'd be many buildings standing except for some of the original ones that were made of stone. St. Paul's Church, which is right near the World Trade Center, is the oldest currently standing building. It's made out of Manhattan schist, which is pretty stable because that's the stuff that the island itself is made out of. it and some of the other stone buildings, perhaps Grand Central, will possibly still be there in some form or another. Some of our glass and steel buildings will really have fallen apart by then. Eventually, of course, all of New York will be scraped away by the next glacier that comes. Now, we may have held off the next glacial age by packing our atmosphere with a lot more insulation these days, but sooner or later we will have glaciation. And, you know, New York 12,000 years ago had just been scraped clean, and as that glacier receded, Homo sapiens followed it in, and a forest regrew there. I think that nature is very patient, and gradually it'll restore things.
Alan, in your book, you try to imagine what might have caused the sudden demise of the Mayan civilization in Central America. What happened there? What can we learn from them?
Well, I inserted that into the book because at a certain point, I think we needed a reality check. And is it possible that a civilization as huge and powerful as ours could possibly break down? And, you know, the Mayan civilization lasted a lot longer than ours. It lasted about 1,800 years, and I'm sure they felt as all-powerful as we feel. And yet, a brilliant archaeologist, Arthur Demarest from Vanderbilt, has been studying it for over 20 years, and he showed me how at a certain point, the Mayan who lived more in harmony than probably any other civilization with the rainforest, they had crops that were interspersed with forest, that they started getting top-heavy. And eventually they started reaching farther and farther and usurping some of their neighbors' land, and then they had to defend their own lands, and then they had to grow their own crops within defensible perimeters, which meant that land got used and reused and overused and abused, and probably a combination of putting so much of their effort into defense and so much of their effort into using exhausted lands to produce foods for their populations just brought them down.
Greed, in other words.
Yeah. The Mayans apparently, as they grew more and more powerful, more and more of that wealth was devoted to things like monuments celebrating the lives of rulers, and then the rulers had a lot of children because they had a lot of wives. More and more of the energy of the society went into producing luxury goods rather than things that they actually needed. And then finally they became so rich that they became attractive to their enemies, and all hell broke loose. A lot of war broke loose.
And the lesson for today then is?
Well, I think that when we find more and more of our treasury being devoted to warfare, to defend ourselves, and to reach farther and farther for resources that we depend on, that eventually we spread ourselves too thin and our base is less stable and that top-heavy society collapses. And that kind of reminds me of a civilization that I happen to be part of right now.
So, Alan, the premise of your book is that all humans disappear from the planet, but my guess is that there are a number of forces that could radically reduce the number of humans on the planet rather abruptly.
Well, there's no question of that, but once a reader gets the sense that nature is as resilient and could be as beautiful so quickly as it was before our Industrial Revolution, I want readers to think about, well, is there something that we could do that would allow us to be part of this mix? So at the very end of the book, I raise another question. Let's put it this way. I pose another fantasy. My original fantasy is, what if we all just went poof and we were gone? And the second one is, well, what if we don't all go poof, but what if for some reason we were impelled as an entire species to try an experiment that the Chinese have tried, which is every one of us, every family only has one child. And I raised that with some demographers, and we found something rather surprising. At the end of the 19th century, there were 1.6 billion people on the planet. Today we have 6.6 billion people, and by the middle of this century, we're headed to 9 billion people, according to the United Nations demographers. If every family, starting tomorrow, only had one child, within a century, we'd be back down to 1.6 billion. Now, I don't suggest this to say that, well, great, then we could start polluting again and we could have all the plastic we wanted and stuff like that because there would be fewer than a third of us as there are today. We need to be doing everything we possibly can to stop pushing other species off the face of the earth, some of whom not only are beautiful, but we may depend on them. You know, our pollinators, for example, may be at risk. But also, we don't want to be poisoning ourselves. I discuss in this book some of the contaminants that are going to be around here for a long time, like PCBs. But this would buy us some time if we learn how to use less toxic materials, if we used far less plastic than we're using now, which is very easy. You just go back to what your grandmother did before World War II, and you don't need all those plastic bags.
What will be the longest-lasting impact of human civilization on the planet for perhaps millions of years to come?
I think that plastics will enter the fossil record, so some trace of them will be there. I think that our radioactive wastes, and, you know, depleted uranium's got a 4.6 billion year half-life, and the Earth probably has about 5 billion years to go before the sun enlarges and consumes it. So that will be around. But there's some other things that actually are nicer to think about. One of the most exciting interviews that I had for this book was with John Lomberg, an artist who was hired by Carl Sagan to compile some of the greatest artifacts of the sounds and images that humans have created of many different cultures and from our own cultures in the West, you know, ranging from Chuck Berry to Mozart, and to append them on a golden disc to the sides of the Voyager spacecraft that are going off into outer space. They've left our solar system, and they should last at least a billion years, sometimes longer. And there's something comforting to know that Mozart's out there. And even longer lasting than those spacecraft will be our radio waves. I mean, this conversation, Steve, it's emanating at the speed of light out into space. Perhaps some civilization way out at the edge of the universe that is advanced enough to perceive us will also be able to pick out our faint signal amidst all the background noise of the universe and get an echo that, well, by the time they get it, the sun may have consumed Earth, but at least get a sense that once we were here.
Alan Weisman's new book is called The World Without Us. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you, Steve.
Just ahead, the mystery of barn owl roadkill. Keep listening to Living on Earth.
Support for the Environmental Health Desk at Living on Earth comes from the Cedar Tree Foundation. Support also comes from the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Fund for coverage of population and the environment. This is Living on Earth on PRI, Public Radio International.